Happy Sabbath. It is so good to be here with you guys. I'm going to put this a little bit to the front so I can get closer to you all. It's been quite a while since I've come up here. And the reason for that is because this year started with a bang. We have so much stuff going on. We went to GYC with a few youth families. We went to Leone Meadows for the pastoral meetings, and then my wife and myself, we were privileged and blessed to be able to visit our family in Brazil for about 10 days, and then we came back, and then we went to Leone Meadows again for the freshman and sophomore retreat. So we've been all over, and then you guys had the women's retreat, and Danny went to that, and so it's, 2020 just started, but who here also has the feeling that it's been going on for a while? You know, we're in the second month, but so much has happened, so much still to happen, not only here at church, but we're noticing so many things in the world. In the first month of this year, we had enough things happening in the world around us to last us the rest of the year. And I saw this picture on Facebook or something. And in the picture, it was one of those memes, and it was saying that, the day that we're at, we're in January 126. That's what it feels like. But so much stuff has happened, so many things have happened, but it is so good to be here at our home church and to be able to see you all and to greet you all and wish you all many blessings. Today we have a very, at least to me, it's one of my favorite stories in the Bible. Before we begin, I know we just prayed, and I'd like to thank Mike for that prayer, but let's just pray again. Your Father, please bless the reading of your word right now. Please be with us and teach us what you want, what you have to tell us this day, Lord. Help us praise you and worship you through this story. In the name of Jesus Christ, amen. So before we get into the story, I'd like to tell you a little story. When I was about, I guess from when I was about 3 to 6 years old, my father was a pastor in the state of New Jersey in a city called Waldwick, New Jersey. Actually, he was a pastor in Newark, but we lived in a small town a few miles away called Waldwick. Has anyone here ever heard of Waldwick, New Jersey? It's very small. I'd be surprised if a lot of people had heard of it. But it's a very small town, and I loved growing up there. We had, in our backyard, behind our backyard, there was an Adventist school, and my sister used to go to school there. And I, when I was about 5, I wanted to start school already because I saw her coming home, and she had friends, and I remember standing at the little gate of our backyard just looking at all the kids leaving school and just wishing that I could just start. But they didn't have kindergarten there. They only had the first grade, so I had to wait, and by the time I was old enough, then we moved to Canada. But I remember this one day where they had this, where my sister at school, she had this day where they split the students up in doubles, in groups of two, and they would make the students pretend to have some kind of disability. And what they were doing was try to put themselves, in the shoes of people with disabilities, people that had difficulties. So my sister, she and her friend, I remember her friend up to this day, her friend's name was Michelle. So my sister's name is Diane. So Diane and Michelle, they decided that what they were going to do was pretend that they were blind. And so for half the day, my sister put on a blindfold and she would, Michelle would help her get around the school, and they would, and then they switched at the second half of the day, and Michelle pretended that she was blind and she put on a blindfold. And my sister got back home and she was so excited, and she's, I know what it's like to be blind. And she was, it's so different, and it's so different and interesting, and now I know what it's like. Of course she had no idea what it was like. But that got me thinking, and it got me intrigued into that reality, And you read in the Bible about so many people that went through this process, and the stories are very deep. If you look at Samson, he lost precisely what part of his body? His eyes, exactly what led him so many times to sin. You see Saul, or later on, the Apostle Paul, that he becomes blind during his conversion and the process of being healed. And what we find out through the rest of the New Testament is that Paul, most interpreters agree that Paul, he had this difficulty with his sight, with his vision. And many agree that that was the thorn that he asked the Lord to remove. And there are just so many stories of people, of blind people in the Bible, so many different miracles and people being healed. And I remember that I started, you know, reading more about it. And my favorite game growing up was Blind Man Bluff. Have you guys ever played Blind Man Bluff? It's where someone, it's kind of like a water polo, Marco Polo out of the water. So you cover your eyes and you have to try to find people, you know, and that was my favorite game. I found out that cats have this extraordinary sense of smell, and that cats, whoever here has a cat, maybe sometimes you see your cat with his mouth open, and he's kind of sniffing around with his open mouth. And what I understood is that enhanced their vision, their capabilities of seeing the world around them. And so many times playing Blind Man Bluff, I'd be blindfolded, but I'd have my mouth open like that, trying to smell have superpowers of smell and all that. The only thing that happened is I'd bang my head around the house. But, you know, that was really an interesting reality for me. And I remember the first times reading this story of this blind man Bartimaeus that emerges in the Bible and thinking that his story was so different from all the other stories that we find of healing or of cure for many reasons. I don't know if you knew this, but in the Gospel of Mark, this is the last miracle of healing attributed to Jesus. It's the last miracle of healing. Another interesting thing is that this is the only miracle that we find the person being healed, we find his name. It's the only miracle where he's named. It's interesting. I hadn't stopped to think about that. But when you look at it, Bartimaeus, we have his name, and that's a different thing. It's a strange thing for us to find this man's name here. The route that they're going to, Jesus is going from Jericho to Jerusalem. This is almost at the end of Jesus' ministry here on earth. This is almost before, you know, he's going to Jerusalem where he would be tried, where he would be judged, where he would be eventually killed and tortured. And so on that process, Jesus is going from Jericho to Jerusalem. It was a trip. It is a trip of about 16 miles. And Jesus is walking all of that. There's this huge crowd surrounding Jesus. If you remember, this is a famous route in the Bible. It's a famous pathway. Do you guys remember in that parable of the Good Samaritan? Where was the victim going to and from? He is going to from Jerusalem, and he was going to Jericho. And Ellen White, she tells us that this story that Jesus used, this parable, it was based on a true story. This pathway, this journey, was known as the pathway of blood, the bloody path, because it was very dangerous. It was a sinuous path. It was very, you know, crooked, and they had ups and downs and turns, and they had caverns and caves everywhere. We actually got to see the ruins of Jericho a few months ago when we went to Israel, and it is a very hilly region. And it was known as this bloody path. There were many thieves, and so that was the reality of that path. And in this story, Jesus, he's coming from a very tense situation. His disciples had been bickering and fighting amongst themselves, wanting to know who was the greatest, who was better, who was bigger, who would be at the right hand of God in heaven. And so Jesus is going from that disappointment, because it's a disappointment. He had been with them for 3.5 years almost, and they were still arguing about these things. He's going to Jerusalem where he knows the things that are going to happen. And all of a sudden in the biblical narrative, we find the story, just 6 verses, about this man that cries out for help. And I'd like to read it with you guys again. I know Chantel read it, and I love that she read it. But just to refresh it in our mind, I'd like to read it again. It says, "Now they came to Jericho, and as he went out of Jericho with his disciples and a great multitude, blind man Bartimaeus, the son of Timaeus, sat by the road begging. And when he had heard that it was Jesus of Nazareth, he began to cry out and say, 'Jesus, son of David, have mercy on me.' Then many warned him to be quiet, but he cried out all the more, 'Son of David, have mercy on me.' So Jesus stood still and commanded him to be called. Then they called the blind man, saying to him, 'Be of good cheer, rise, he is calling you.' And throwing aside his garment, he rose and came to Jesus. So Jesus answered and said to him, 'What do you want me to do for you?' The blind man said to him, 'Rabboni, that I may receive my sight.' Then Jesus said to him, 'Go your way, your faith has made you well.' And immediately he received his sight and followed Jesus on the road." Jesus is going the 16 miles. A crowd is all around him, pressing around him. All of a sudden, a blind man yells out, "Son of David, have mercy on me." The crowd, initially, what's their reaction? They tell him to be quiet, to shut up. Bartimaeus, shut up, be quiet. Why did they say that? Oftentimes I try to put myself in the story and they knew who Jesus was. They knew that Jesus healed people. Wouldn't this be another exciting moment to see a miracle? Why did they tell him to shut up, to be quiet? There are possible reasons. Perhaps they didn't like, many in the crowd did not like him calling Jesus the son of David. This is the only time that this appears in this gospel. Jesus is not called the son of David anywhere else in this gospel. You see, the son of David, calling someone that was attributing to them messianity. And that was blasphemy. Maybe they didn't like that. Maybe they wanted to arrive quickly in Jerusalem for Passover. They were tired. They had a long walk ahead of them. Maybe Bartimaeus was just making this big noise and it was embarrassing. We don't know. But the crowd told him to shut up and be quiet. And that is something that I find really interesting, because in our life, there are so many people around us that tell us to be quiet when we are crying out to Jesus. There are so many people that try to suppress our cry, try to suppress our relationship with God, try to suppress our message. That is a constant reality in the world around us. But Bartimaeus, he isn't even fazed, and he cries out even more, "Jesus, son of David, have mercy on me." What does Jesus do? What does Jesus do? Jesus does what? This is a question, not a rhetorical one. What does Jesus do? He calls him to come, right? Is that the first thing Jesus does? Is that the first verb that we find in the text attributed to Jesus? No. What does Jesus do first? He stops. He stands still. And my friends, I find such an extraordinary eloquence in this verbal action. The fact that the Bible records that Jesus stops. It could have just said Jesus called him, but the Bible says Jesus stood still, he stopped. And that just gives me a glimpse into the character of God. Because while so many other people walked past him, while so many other people just passed him by, the Bible finds it important to say that Jesus stopped. Would you have stopped? Do you stop? You know, usually when we go through these kinds of situations, and look, all of us go through them, when someone starts, a questionable person on the street starts talking to us, or you know, someone that lives on the streets, they start talking to you, many times we tend to ignore them, or we kind of treat them as if they weren't even people. We tend to We tend to dehumanize people that we don't want to interact with. No, it's not, you know, they might be sick, they might be dangerous. Aren't these the excuses that run through our mind? Not Jesus. Jesus stops. You see, Jesus is the master at stopping. And with this, he attributes dignity, honor, value, nobility to a person to whom no one before had done that to. You see, Bartimaeus, he was the very essence, the very definition of the word marginalized. While everyone else went ahead in life and they went on their path and their journey of life, Bartimaeus stayed to the side of the road, still, alone, ignored, invisible. You know, sometimes I've thought before how horrible it must be to be invisible to the people around you. Think about it. You all have family. We all have family. We have friends. We have people that love us. Even if we go through something difficult or hard, there are people that care about us. We come to church. We have brotherly love. But there are people in this world that have nobody. And there is nothing they can say. There's nothing they can do to make people truly see them. Humans are masters at dehumanizing people. That's a hard word for me. Humans are masters at dehumanizing themselves or each other. Imagine how desperate, how horrible must be the feeling of trying to make yourself seen, but no one sees you. Jesus was a master at seeing what nobody else saw, at finding gold in the mud. You know, sometimes I wonder, I think that if Jesus, he had to put a price tag on a human being, the price would be so big that it would be impossible for us to read. You know, the Pharisees, the society, they didn't even feel that it was their job or it was required of them to feel pity on people like Bartimaeus. In fact, there's a book, there's a scroll called The War Between the Sons of Light and the Sons of Darkness. And it was written by the Essenes, which were another group of Jews back then. And the Essenes, they wrote this scroll. And in that scroll, the cripple, the blind, the mute, the women and children, they could not participate in the battle against the sons of Belial, the demon Belial. And because they could not participate, they were excluded from the feast. That was Bartimaeus' life. In fact, do you know what Bartimaeus means, the name? In a society where names are so meaningful, where names were kind of like a prophecy about what that person's life would be, Bartimaeus literally means son of pollution, son of filth. The son of Timaeus, the son of filth. What does that tell us about his family, his parents? What did they consider him? Filth, pollution. This was Bartimaeus' life, day after day after day. Many Bible interpreters, they believe that the story in Mark chapter 10 is not the same story, not the same miracle of Luke, where Jesus heals two blind men. And I'm not going to discuss that. You could go either way. But Bartimaeus had been blind for a very long time. If not from birth, he had been blind for a very long time. What's worse, not only the condition ailed his life, but the stigma of the condition. Many Pharisees prided themselves in throwing rocks at these blind men, thinking they were doing a great service because these people were sinners. Do you guys remember the blind man in the book of John? Where the disciples asked Jesus, Lord, who sinned, him or his parents? Because in the Jewish mentality of the days, you could sin inside your mother's womb. That's what they believed. So in the case of Bartimaeus, either he was a great big sinner or his family was a sinner, but in any case, he did not even deserve pity. He didn't deserve any kind of mercy because he was a sinner. But Jesus stops. Jesus stops. And that just tells me, my dear friend, maybe you are dwelling in a pit of sin. Maybe you are in bondage to sin, trying to escape. Maybe, you know, there's a song called People Need the Lord. I might have mentioned that here before. Have you ever heard that song, People Need the Lord? And there's a part in that song that says that laughter hides their silent cries. And maybe you come to church laughing and smiling and saying you're all right, just like Sister Esme said. Maybe you're here and you say, I'm fine, but you're really not. Maybe laughter hides your silent cries. Let me tell you, Jesus knows and Jesus stops for you. The text then says that Jesus, he calls him and says, come, Bartimaeus. And the crowd that 1 second before was saying, shut up, be quiet, we don't want to hear you. That crowd says, be of good cheer. Did you know that in the Gospel of Mark, be of good cheer, it appears 7 times. 6 times from the lips of Jesus. 1 time from the lips of the crowd right here. Be of good cheer. And so Bartimaeus, probably knew that Jesus was a healer, that Jesus was, you know, he could cure him. Bartimaeus, I imagine he jumps up. And I can't imagine the scene. Jesus is some feet away, and Bartimaeus, he throws back his cloak. He has his little walking stick. And I imagine that Bartimaeus, with his eyes looking upward, trying to see where he's going, he's now before Jesus, overjoyed, because what does he think is going to happen? What is his expectation? That Jesus is going to heal him. And he thinks, finally, it's going to be different. Life is going to change. I'm going to get better. This is such a great thing. This man that had received so many different punches and blows from life, now he feels, look, this is going to change, finally. It's going to be different. But then Jesus asks him this question. A very strange question. What does Jesus ask him? What do you want me to do for you? My friends, I'm sorry, but that is, by human vision, by human understanding, by our terms, that is a fairly oblivious question. To put it that way. It's a very weird question to ask of a blind man that is claiming for mercy on the side of a road, everyone knowing that you're a healer. I imagine what went through Bartimaeus' mind at that moment. You know, he could have thought, look, everyone sees that I'm blind. I can't be more exposed than I am right now. Everyone already considers me a sinner. Doesn't Jesus know what I want? Is Jesus mocking me? Is he making fun of me? This could be seen as a new blow on an old wound. But the beauty of the story is that Bartimaeus, he answers this question as if he truly thought that Jesus did not know what he wanted. And he said, Master, I want to see. And Jesus answered him and says, Bartimaeus, go your way, for you are saved. And then Bartimaeus' eyes are opened, he can see again, and the story finishes, these six verses finish telling us that he followed Jesus throughout that crowd. And the story is done. That story finishes right there, leaving us with a considerable amount of questions. I don't know about you, but I'm that kind of person that when I get to the end of a movie, that's when I would want to start watching. Because that's when the happily ever after part happens, isn't it? Isn't that the part where the whole problem is solved and people are going to start being happy? Isn't that the good part? That's where I want to watch. I want to see the good stuff. I want to see the happy stuff. And I wanted to know what Bartimaeus' life was like after Jesus healed him. But never again does Bartimaeus appear in the narrative of the Bible. And that leaves us with many questions. And this is where we have to imagine what it would mean to receive our vision, to receive sight after a prolonged time in darkness without seeing. Now, typically we would imagine that it's a good thing, right? Wouldn't you imagine that it's a good thing to see after a long time? We could even paint kind of like a romantic picture of this story. He saw colors and shapes in people's faces. We could, you know, these little windows through which we see the world. We could paint a very romantic, a very nice picture of this occasion, of this story. A few years ago, I was reading this article written by an eye doctor from Johns Hopkins University. And the article was about the experience of recovering your sight after a long time without seeing, after a long time with blindness. And to my surprise, the immediate experience is not good. According to this doctor, as soon as you receive sight after a prolonged time in the dark, you become disoriented. You don't know where you are, you don't know what's going on. Then dizziness comes. People often fall down and trip. Then a feeling of nausea, vomiting. They feel sick. And after that, a lingering feeling of depression. You know why depression? Because the world does not adjust to their expectation of it. Oftentimes it happens that when someone receives their sight after a long time without seeing or being born blind, they imagine the world in a different way. Colors a different way, trees a different way, spouses different ways. But when they open their eyes, they're confronted with the reality, and the reality is oftentimes not what they expected. So, you know, we can kind of come back to the story of Bartimaeus under these circumstances, pressed by that crowd, the light of the sun shining down and blinding him and hurting his eyes, maybe tripping and falling, very dizzy, disoriented, nauseous, confused that the world isn't what he expected it to be. Sight at the first few moments is not what he thought it would be. Think about what happened the rest of that day. He walks with Jesus, but at one point he has to go back home, doesn't he? How does he go back home if he's never seen his way back home? Very probably the people that helped him get to and from the place where he asked for money, they abandoned him thinking what? Well, he can see now. What does he need us for? But Bartimaeus had never seen his way home. I imagine him maybe covering again his eyes that at this point are hurting and aching, and again trying to create maybe a mental map of the way it used to be before. Maybe he arrives at his, I don't know, neighbor's house or in his neighborhood and he asks, hey, do you know where I live? What a weird question. Think about what happened in the following weeks and months. What did Bartimaeus do to survive? What was his forms of survival before? Begging. But who's going to give money to an ex-blind man that can now see and has no excuse? His family? Maybe his children, his parents, I don't know. Now they tell him, look, Bartimaeus,
you have no excuse. Get into the rat race. Support yourself. Stop being a hindrance and a weight to society. But what does Bartimaeus know how to do? What can he do? What does Bartimaeus know how to be? A beggar. And now I can imagine that Bartimaeus, he starts to question himself. He starts to think, well, was this request wise? Did I really want to see? Because you see, there was a certain comfort in being blind. He knew how to be blind. He knew how to act and how to live as a blind man. It was safe. But the true question is now is, how do I live seeing? How do I live with sight? The fact is that Bartimaeus is not he's not well. In a word, he's not doing that well. And what is his problem? He can now see. And that question that Jesus asked, Bartimaeus, what do you want me to do for you? It starts to make sense. Bartimaeus, are you sure you want to see? Are you sure that you want to go through disorientation? Are you sure you want to be dizzy and confused and nauseous? Do you want to go through the sadness of not adjusting your thoughts and your expectations to the reality of life? Are you sure, Bartimaeus, that you want to see? You know, for the longest time, I've asked myself, why is this story in the Bible? Why is it here? This is what in theology we call a non sequitur. And basically a non sequitur is a story that doesn't fit into the context in which it's inserted. So think about it. In the verses before, we find Jesus going through complicated circumstances. He is going through a crisis in his discipleship, in his disciples. He knows that he's going to Jerusalem, where he's going to be tried, he's going to be tortured, he's going to be killed, and all sorts of horrible things are going to happen. But in the middle of all of this, this story about this blind man Bartimaeus, it emerges in the narrative of the Bible, soon to disappear again. And I've asked myself many times, why? I'm sure many things must have happened in Jesus' life that could have been included. Why this story? Why is this important? And my friends, the conclusion that I come to is that the Bible is a canvas. And the stories of these people, their stories of their encounters and re-encounters with Jesus, they go beyond themselves. Because in the last case, these stories, they are our biography. They're the stories of people who, just like us, have to, at one moment or another in life, they have to meet Jesus. So when I see Bartimaeus' story, I see me. They say that sunlight goes through about 300 feet. And here, you know, you have some differences in opinion. But let's say it goes about 300 feet into the waters of the sea. And after that, what we find are the murky depths, dark. You know, the creatures that are born in the depth, they are even born with optic nerves. But because of their constant contact with the darkness, their nerves become atrophied. It's doubly worse for us because we are born spiritually blind. And we can't see. You know, the Bible tells us in John 3:19, it says, and this is the condemnation, that the light has come into the world, and men love darkness rather than light, because their deeds were evil. There are many people, and this is the story that I hear all around me many times, where people say, you know what, I can't believe in the Bible, I can't believe in God, this just doesn't make sense, and their life just goes downhill from there. Maybe that's happened to you. Maybe that's happened to people that you know. And it seems that disbelief is generated by disobedience. That disobedience is generated by disbelief. I can't believe in this. I can't believe in the Bible. It doesn't make sense. But Blaise Pascal, the great scientist, he once said that it is the other way around. It is disbelief that leads to disobedience. If I start questioning, if I start doubting God and wanting my own lifestyle, then I will start going that slippery way down. And the problem is that many people don't want to see. You know, we would, as humans, in many moments, prefer the darkness. And don't let that surprise you. Because in the moment where we start seeing, we have to change. When I start seeing, I start seeing the reality of the way I treat people, of the way I treat my family, of the way that I do things, I do business, the way that I go to school, the way that I talk, the way that I walk. I start seeing that I have to change because light brings change. But also, light hurts. Vision hurts. Seeing hurts. Have you ever tried turning on the light of the bathroom in the middle of the night? Aren't you shocked? That happens to me every so often. Seeing hurts. It's not a comfortable thing. And many people would rather say, when Jesus asks, look, what would you want me to do for you? Many people, millions in the world around us, they say, Father, Lord, I'm fine. Just leave me the way I am. I know how to dress the right way. I know how to talk the right thing. I know how to sing the right music. I know how to read the Bible, at least. I know how to teach a Sabbath school. I know how to preach up front. I know how to lead. I know how to do this. You know what? I don't want anymore. I'm fine the way I am. Just leave me. I don't want to see. The Bible says that men preferred darkness because their deeds were evil. But you know, there are many others in the world around us, many of us who would answer, Father, Lord, I know it's going to hurt. I know it's not going to be comfortable. I know that it will be, I will be dizzy and it will be confusing. I know that I might hurt myself and get a slight depression. But Father, I cannot bear to go on the way I've been going. I cannot bear to walk on the way I've been walking. I don't want to live the way I've been living. I don't want to hurt people the way I have or hurt myself the way I have. I don't want to. Father, please, Master, open my eyes so that I may see. Now, you know, I just turned 30. It was I was kind of love-hate experience for me. You know, when I thought about turning 30 years old, it was so far off. The last time I thought about it, I thought that 30 was already over the hill, and now I'm pushing it away to 35, and then I'll get to 40, you know, and 50, and I guess that's how life goes. Not saying that anyone here is over the hill, all right? Don't get me wrong. That has to do with me. But I guess I'm still quite young. And if you ask me, as a young guy, my friends, I cannot find a lot of contentment in this world around me. I can't. I'm not saying that I'm depressed. I'm not. I'm a happy guy. I'm not depressed. I'm not, you know, having dark thoughts. But I find no pleasure in a lot of stuff that people my age do. I'm not saying I'm better, because I'm not. I'm saying that in the end, we all go to the same place. In the end, we all die, and in the end, our big dreams, they're burned down. In the end, our houses that we build and the cars that we buy, they go to other people. In the end, your bank account will be passed on to someone like the wise man in Ecclesiastes says, and I don't know what they're going to do with it. In the end, nothing is yours. Nothing truly is yours. It all passes. For many of you, you can recount, you can tell me, for you older folks, you can tell me about decades gone by that seem to have gone like this. What are you looking at in your life? What is worth looking to? Or have you been blinded by sight, by apparent sight? Thinking and imagining that there's so many things that are so important. Maybe degrees, diplomas, relationships, friends, and the esteem of your peers. Let me tell you, that all fades away. And at one moment when Jesus comes, and this will happen because it happens to everybody. At one moment, at some point in your life, Jesus will always come at one point and he will say, what can I do for you? What do you want me to do for you? And you might say, look, I'm fine the way I am. I don't want to change. I'm fine. That is a possible reaction. But for many others, maybe you will say, Lord, I don't want to continue the same. I don't want to go on being who I have been. You know, when I was a child and we used to go to my uncle's farm back in Brazil, it didn't have any energy yet at that moment. And I used to love looking at thunderstorms because it was all dark in one moment. It was pitch black, all dark. But in that split second where you find the lightning, it comes and it goes. It seemed to me always that after the lightning disappeared, the tyranny of the dark wasn't so strong anymore because I saw what was out there. I knew the reality. Jesus was that lightning that flashed down in human history, breaking the tyranny of the dark. You see, Jesus is like the sun. We don't believe in the sun only because we see it, but because through it we see everything else. Isn't that true? Jesus is that way. You don't believe in him only because you see him, but because through him you see everything else. So my prayer, my dear friends, my prayer for you, dear brother, sister, young person, youth, child, is that when Jesus comes and he asks you, what do you want me to do for you? My prayer is that your answer is, Lord, open my eyes that I may see. I'm tired of the way things have been. I don't want to go on this way. That whole lie, the illusion I've given myself, it's not panning up to what I thought it would be. Lord, I want to see. Open my eyes. We're going to sing a song now called Open My Eyes, Lord, That I May See. As we sing this song, and I invite the choristers to come up, as we sing this song, friends, may this be your prayer. Open my eyes, Lord, that I may see. It might hurt, might be confusing, but open my eyes, Lord. May God bless you, may God bless you, and may God bless you.